You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Teresa Katsarilis, filling in for Philip Yun. Israeli politics are moving fast right now. We're recording this on June 3rd, and at this particular moment, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's political career hangs in the balance. His opponents have cobbled together a diverse coalition of right-wingers and leftists, and they don't tend to agree on very much of anything. But no matter who wins Israel's latest political battle, here's one thing we know for sure. Palestinians see little hope for real change. Israelis and Palestinians are still recovering from last month's bloody conflict. And unless something changes, the crisis is expected to devolve into war again. So this week, we're diving into some of the underlying issues that have fueled a wider crisis. Ray Suarez takes us to a small stone house in East Jerusalem.
Marhaba, Samira.
Samira Dajani's garden is a green tunnel of grapevines and almond trees, with a pink bougainvillea plant weighing down the trellis. Terry Bulata spent a lot of time here when she was a kid.
Samira is a teacher at a school where my mother was also a teacher. So I grew up to see Auntie Samira, as we call her, for ages, you know.
Today, Terry has children of her own. Samira and her husband, Adel, are empty nesters in their 70s. Though they still keep a swing set in their yard. Samira inherited this house from her parents.
We planted trees, roses together. And when I grew up and I became a teacher, many students came to our garden to take lessons in Arabic language. So it was a nice memory here in my house.
She lives in Sheikh Jarrah, a neighborhood in East Jerusalem. The majority of residents here are Palestinian. And for almost 50 years, its residents have been locked in a legal battle with Jewish settlers.
Yes, I can see the signs in Hebrew. So these are the settlers' houses, and they took over.
A group has already moved in next door. And for Samira, they're a constant reminder of what's at stake here. On August 1st, Samira and Adel might be forced to leave. These settlers claim that Samira's home and the homes of her neighbors actually belong to them, and that they have the documentation to prove it. The dispute boiled over last month, when the Jerusalem District Court sided with the settlers and ruled that a handful of Sheikh Jarrah families needed to move out immediately. The families appealed to Israel's Supreme Court, which agreed to weigh in on the case, but many expected the justices to side with the settlers too. Protesters marched through the streets of Samira's quiet neighborhood. Terry and her family visited as often as they could in solidarity.
The other night, my daughter was able to come to Auntie Samira's house. Her neighbor was also celebrating her 33 years old birthday. And, you know, the neighbors all together were singing happy birthday. And then they came into the beautiful garden of Samira, and Samira was pouring coffee for her. And suddenly the soldiers came into the garden, inside the house, and started bringing my daughter from her hair and her girlfriends out to the streets, hitting them hard and kicking them and dragging them out of the neighborhood. And my daughter was saying, but I'm doing nothing. I'm drinking coffee. What are you doing? Unfortunately, the soldiers kicked them out and beat them very hard. And that's the daily reality.
Activists managed to take shaky videos of the incident, then forwarded them to Terry. On them, you can see Israeli border guards pushing her daughter to the street and shoving another woman to the ground. I talked with Terry and Samira on May 17th, after the Israeli-Palestinian crisis had erupted into another bloody conflict. The Sheikh Jarrah evictions had mobilized Palestinians and their supporters throughout the region, and it helped spark an all-out war. Samira's family has lived in Jerusalem for generations. They used to live in the west of the city, but that changed in the 1948 war.
United Nations laws have established Palestine as a free and independent state, to be known as Israel.
The United Nations attempted to partition Palestine into two states, one Jewish and one ethnically Arab, and neither side was satisfied with the deal. Violence broke out almost immediately.
The city of Haifa in its harbor become the center of bitter conflict as the new Jewish state is born in the tense atmosphere of civil war.
Israel calls this their war of independence, but Palestinians like Samira call it the Nakba.
In one word, it is a catastrophe, we can say. It is the meaning of a catastrophe.
Haganah forces seek out every Arab, and barricades are set up to screen those who had not already fled the city.
Over 700,000 Palestinians either fled or were forced from their homes. Samira's family was among them. Jerusalem was split in two. Israel seized the west of the city. Jordan seized its eastern neighborhoods, including Sheikh Jarrah. Samira's family spent a few years shuttling between refugee camps. Then, in 1956, the Jordanian government offered Samira's parents a deal in Sheikh Jarrah. Terry Boulada explained how that deal worked.
It was like a pilot project by the Jordanian government. So they took this 28 families as a test case. The lands were given to those refugees, West Jerusalem from Jaffa, Haifa, and the rule was for in exchange to your refugee status, we give you the lands to settle down in, and you give us your refugee rights.
The project was the result of an agreement between Jordan and the United Nations Agency for Refugees.
So those 28 families, they said, okay, we will accept this exchange. We don't want to be refugees within our own country. So we accept that you give us this land. And that was the deal.
Jordan's government promised to grant the families ownership of their new homes within 3 years.
But unfortunately, the Jordanian, with their weak bureaucracy, unfortunately didn't happen. And the Israeli occupation in 67 was started.
In 1967's Six-Day War, Israel seized East Jerusalem along with the West Bank and Gaza. And after so many military occupations, families like Samira's found themselves in a legal no-man's land.
So these 28 families were put in the corner where they have no full property ownership by the Jordanian government.
Then in 1972, a group of Jewish settlers filed a lawsuit. They said a slice of land in Sheikh Jarrah belonged to them. And unlike Samira and her neighbors, they had the documents to prove it. Under Israeli law, Jewish citizens can reclaim land that Jordan took from them in the 1948 war. So in accordance with that law, the right to Samira's family home reverted to its previous owners. Then the settlers claimed to have bought the land from those owners, a group of Jewish trusts that had purchased a piece of Sheikh Jarrah way back in 1876. For the settlers, the situation here is pretty simple. They can prove they own these homes in Sheikh Jarrah. Sure, things might be different if Samira and her neighbors had their own title to properties, but they don't. Israeli officials have described this as a real estate dispute, and it's not hard to see why. Samira and Terry have many, many problems with this. For example, many Sheikh Jarrah families claim the settlers' deeds to their homes are invalid for a variety of reasons. But according to Samira, we shouldn't accept the terms of the settlers' argument in the first place because the bigger issue here is that Israeli property law discriminates against Palestinians. Israeli Jews are allowed to reclaim property they lost during the 1948 war, but Palestinians are not. Samira, if you lose in court, does that mean that you can go, you can say, I want my family's old land back now?
They will refuse. They will refuse to let us go back to our properties because they have two laws. One for them, one for Arabs.
And according to Terry, the settler's case conveniently skips over a glaring legal issue. After the 1967 war, Israel annexed East Jerusalem, but that move has not been recognized by the international community. East Jerusalem is still considered occupied territory.
According to international law, the occupier has no ruling over occupied territory, and the occupiers have no right to transfer their residents to the occupied territory.
In a press release last month, a spokesperson for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights reiterated that Israel shouldn't impose its own laws in occupied territory, and it definitely shouldn't encourage settlers to move there.
And so this is the problem. While we understand that the Jordanians were very late and very bureaucratic, that delayed the issue of completion of registration of houses in the name of the Palestinian people who moved in exchange for the refugee status, the Israelis come in against all international law to not only forcibly evict the Palestinians from Sheikh Jarrah or any other houses that they take grip over, but also they transfer their Jewish residents into these neighborhoods. And that's a major problem that Sheikh Jarrah is symbolic about.
Sheikh Jarrah isn't the only East Jerusalem neighborhood where Palestinians live under threat of eviction. According to Peace Now, an Israeli group that advocates for a two-state solution, 200 Palestinian homes are currently threatened by eviction. Another 20,000 homes are being threatened with demolition.
Unfortunately, despite the international law, especially the international humanitarian law, is very clear about these issues when it comes to occupied territory, the state of Israel not only built settlements all around Jerusalem, cutting it from the rest of the occupied territory. They started enclaving East Jerusalem with Israeli settlements all over, with belts of settlements. And on top of that, they started from 72 to break into East Jerusalem itself in order to enforce their grip. The Sheikh Jarrah case is not a property dispute as the Israeli government and the media machine are selling. It is a conflict over occupied and occupier. We see Israel as a settler colonial regime has continued, you know, settling our land and pushing us more and more out of our country.
To Terry, it's clear why this is happening. She says Israel is trying to consolidate Jewish control in East Jerusalem, and there's evidence that's true. In 2004, Jerusalem's municipality published an urban master plan, which explicitly stated it wanted to keep the city's Arab population capped at 30%.
Unfortunately for them, despite all these policies for planning, for residency, with all the things that we're seeing now, home demolition, the number of Palestinians in Jerusalem, especially in East Jerusalem I'm talking, have remained around 40%. And that's driving the Israeli government nuts. And therefore, they started coming into East Jerusalem with their settlers, with their discriminatory policy of residency, of planning, and the Sheikh Jarrah is one of those cases. That's why the Palestinian people's anger is so much.
Does it feel to you like the Israeli government is right now, as we're talking, trying to shift what is acceptable? How does it feel to you? Do you feel like you cannot move as freely, that you cannot live your life, that you, as an Arab citizen, are watching your rights, your freedom decline?
Yes, you know, nowadays we feel that they want to shock us without even having the basic human right to express our daily needs as human beings. We want a rights-based approach to this conflict. You know, to be honest, as a 55 years old person now, I don't care about one state or two states if my right as a human being will be guaranteed.
The latest Israeli-Palestinian war was short and brutal. When it comes to Sheikh Jarrah, it didn't resolve much of anything. Shortly after the conflict started, Israel's Supreme Court delayed its decision on whether to expel a group of families there and asked Israel's Attorney General to review the case. For Samira and Terry, the situation is still fraught with tension. A few days after the war ended, a Palestinian man was shot dead after stabbing two Israelis. Israeli police have arrested hundreds of Palestinian protesters. And Terry is a little uneasy about Hamas's involvement. The militant group claimed to be firing rockets into Israel in defense of Sheikh Jarrah, but Terry disagrees with them politically.
We also understand psychologically, the more you push people to no hope, the more they tend to go towards God in order to pray and await for some hope and, you know, light at the end of the tunnel. The priorities are clear. First, freedom, freedom from occupation, dignity, and secondly, the democratization process. And we will never give up those two plight to fight for it. And we always say, especially in the women movement, that freedom from occupation and the democratization of our country go hand in hand. Today, we have to fight against occupation, but the second day, I will be fighting against any Palestinian ruling authority who will undermine my rights as a Palestinian citizen for dignity, for freedom of expression, for freedom to elect my candidates and the government. And we will never give up the fight for a better future. But priorities first.
As for Samira, well, as of this reporting, it's unclear whether the court will let her stay in her home or not. For now, she's watching and waiting. Have you thought about where you will go if you lose the court case?
First of all, we are thinking that we will stay to the last minute here. But in this case, I'm asking the world, if you put yourself in our shoes, where are you going? Knocking doors, tents, or where? Where can we go?
Samira, Terry, thank you all for talking to me.
Thank you.
For many Palestinians, the fight to save Sheikh Jarrah has become something of a battle cry. But for Jewish Israelis, this is yet another issue that sharply divides them. On May 21st, hundreds of people, Israeli and Palestinian, joined together in protest against forced evictions in Sheikh Jarrah. And Terry Boulada says some Jewish Israelis are among the neighborhood's strongest supporters. But according to a 2020 opinion poll, Israelis are evenly split over their country's annexation of East Jerusalem and parts of the West Bank. Settlers have received widespread support from Israel's right-wing governments, not to mention funding from abroad.
Yaakov, you know this is not your house.
Yes, but
you may have seen this video recently.
You are stealing my house.
And if I don't steal it, someone else is going to steal it.
In it, Sheikh Jarrah resident Mona El-Kurd confronts Jacob Fauci, a settler who moved into a part of her family's house. An Israeli court determined that part of the property actually belongs to a U.S.-based settler organization called Nahalot Shimon International. Nahalot Shimon is a plaintiff in the Sheikh Jarrah case, and the Israeli Supreme Court may well rule in their favor. To help you understand their perspective, we spoke with someone who knows it well.
Hi, my name is Avi Bell. I'm a professor at the University of San Diego School of Law and at Bar-Ilan University's Faculty of Law in Israel. I'm speaking to you from Jerusalem.
How do you view, in legal terms, the situation in Sheikh Jarrah? Are we talking just about a property dispute or part of a larger Israeli policy to change the demographic makeup of the area?
Well, it is a landlord-tenant dispute. It's a landlord-tenant dispute that's gone on now for almost 50 years. It's gone in and out through several proceedings in court starting in 1972. But the State of Israel is not a party to these proceedings. So it doesn't involve any Israeli policy other than the policy decision that Israel will eventually have to make when the Supreme Court issues its final ruling. Will it uphold the law or not? That's the only question for the State of Israel. The case is being brought by the owner. It's a corporation called Nachlat Shimon. Nachlat Shimon purchased its rights in 2003 from two different land funds. They were the Ashkenazi community and the Sephardic community land funds. They purchased the land in 1875. The reason they purchased it as land funds was because under Ottoman law, and this was part of the Ottoman Empire at the time, under Ottoman law, it was nearly impossible for Jews to buy land as individuals, but it was possible for them to do so under religious trusts. And so almost all of the purchases of land by Jews at that time, during the late 19th century, were done by these kinds of trust funds, religious trust funds. And the religious trust held the title from 1875 through their sale to Nachlat Shimon in 2003, except for a 19-year period in which the Jordanian custodian of enemy property sequestered those properties during its occupation of East Jerusalem.
Well, I'm glad you brought up that entity and the whole idea of enemy property. This is a part of the world that's changed hands several times just in the last, 120 years. There's been a lot of lines drawn in that part of the world. Does title stay constant in that kind of world where both administrative powers and colonial powers and wars are changing the boundaries of places?
So, yes, for the most part, but there are some very big exceptions. So land title that was established under the Ottoman Empire, held through the British Mandate of Palestine, and then afterwards through Jordan, if Jordan conquered that territory, and the State of Israel. However, all of these countries, the Ottoman Empire, the British Mandate, Jordanians, and the Israelis, applied some form of enemy property law in which it sequestered private property of enemy civilians. I used to live in Jerusalem in an area called the German Colony. That was an area that was primarily owned by private German individuals. All of it was sequestered by the British custodian for enemy property during the 1930s. And the British ended up never returning any of that property. They ended up selling it to private individuals, and some of it ended up in my hands.
So could a German go back and say, look, you know, I had a house in the German colony in Jerusalem, and I'm not sure it should have become British territory?
So sequestered enemy property is not an invention of the Ottoman Empire or the British or Israel or Jordan. It's something that's well known in international law. It actually appears in the commentary of the Fourth Geneva Convention. It says that basically every state at the time in 1949 used to sequester enemy property. And sequestered enemy property is taken temporarily by the custodian, but the custodian has the right to convey title. And that means if the custodian sells it, it'll never go back to the original owner. If the custodian holds on to it to the end of the conflict, then it may end up going back to the original owner. None of the Germans are going to get back their property. Some of the property that was sequestered by the Ottomans has actually gone back. There was a sequestered Russian property that's gone back. And I imagine that when the Israeli-Palestinian conflict ends, some of that property will go back to Palestinians.
Some of the families of Sheikh Jarrah ended up there because the places they used to live became part of Israel proper and were now occupied by Jewish families. Will they be able to return to their old hometowns and demand their homes back? And if not, why not?
So it follows the rules of sequestered property. So where the custodian, in Israel, most of the sequestered property was sequestered by the custodian for absentee property rather than a custodian for enemy property. But where the custodian is held onto the property, it may eventually be released back to the original owner when the conflict is over. But most of the sequestered property, all these custodians, Jordanian, Israeli, British, Ottoman, Most of it has already been transferred to the private market. Where it's been transferred, it's not going to go back. So my guess is that the former owners of property in Jerusalem that was sequestered by Israel are going to end up getting money compensation rather than their actual land back.
Wasn't there a law passed by Israel specifically to block attempts from returning Palestinians who had lived under Ottoman rule, who had fled during the various wars, who came back and said, yeah, this is my house?
No, there is no such law. The absentee property law states specifically that property that is sequestered is held in custody under the general rules of sequestration. That is, it's to be returned at the end of the conflict, or it's to be, or compensation is to be paid. There is no reference to Palestinian or Jew. It's an ethnic-free law. And Article 28 of the law specifically says that the custodian is permitted, prior to the end of the conflict, to release custody. And that has happened. There's right now this huge fight going on about gentrification in Jaffa. Part of it involves sequestered absentee property that was released back to the owners. So no, there's nothing preventing specifically Palestinians from going back and getting their sequestered property at the end of the conflict. That's simply a myth.
You mentioned in your previous answer that there's no reference to Arabs or Jews. Is there any sense in the law in which Arabs and Jews are regarded differently when it comes to property rights? And does the right of return give Jews different rights when it comes to both property and residence in Israel proper?
So the laws are all ethnic neutral. That is, the same property laws apply to Arabs and to Jews. There is a historical aspect to this, that is, enemy property that was taken by the various regimes that have controlled the land have obviously taken from citizens of enemy states, or from the property of civilians that associated with the states that they considered to be enemies. And that means that the British primarily took German property, and the Ottomans primarily took the property of enemies of the Ottoman Empire. The Jordanians primarily took Jewish property, and Israel primarily took Arab property. But that's not an artifact of ethnic discrimination per se. That's just an artifact of how the conflicts went. Now, the other thing that you mentioned, a right of return, Israel does offer a right of return to Jews to immigrate. It doesn't involve any particular property rights. And that right of return is offered to Jews of the world and to no one else of the world. All the rest of the world, if it wants to immigrate to Israel, has to follow the normal immigration process. And Israel has a citizenship law that offers five different branches for getting citizenship besides the right of return of Jews, although they haven't been widely used. That is, there are not a large number of lawful immigrants to Israel other than Jews.
So if you are from a family that lived in what's now Beersheba or Nazareth or Haifa for generations previous, rights having to do with property are in a totally different area from those having to do with being able to become a legal resident of those places again, based on your past, based on your derivation?
Yeah, the property rights are not affected by the citizenship of the owner, other than the fact that it might have been sequestered under any one of these enemy property statutes. But if it's not sequestered property, the fact that you're a citizen of Iran today, or a citizen of Morocco, or a citizen of Britain, or whatever else, does not affect your property rights. It's the same property rights. If you're a landlord or a tenant, you're using the same landlord and tenant laws, and you will have the same rights.
In the modern era, aren't there disputed places like this scattered all over the world? Can a Portuguese citizen fly back to Mozambique and ask for a family farm back? Can an Indonesian demand East Timor restore property given by the Suharto government after Indonesia invaded and seized the former European colony?
For the most part, no. And but that is the rule in Israel as well. more or less, no one can go and demand that their sequestered property be returned. They may request it, and it's not likely to happen until the end of the conflict. And by the end of the conflict, there isn't going to be much sequestered property left. What they're going to end up getting, in almost all cases, is some form of monetary compensation. And that is something that happens elsewhere, and that's really the only viable solution in Israel as well.
Avi Bell is a professor at the University of San Diego School of Law and a member of the Faculty of Law at Bar-Ilan University. He joined us from Jerusalem. Thanks for joining us on World Affairs, Professor.
Thank you.
You've been listening to World Affairs. Our program is produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from TPG and First Republic Bank, and from listeners like you. If you want to support the program by becoming a member or making a donation of any size, please go to worldaffairs.org/donate. And we want to hear from you. What did you think about this episode? Do you have any ideas for future stories? Please email us at feedback@worldaffairs.org. Our production team includes Elise Manoukian, Mateo Schimpf, Jared Sport, and me, Teresa Katsarilis. Tatum Sanderbeck manages our website. Our executive producer is Joanne Jennings. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Our music is from Blue Dot Sessions. Our CEO is Philip Young, and I'm Teresa Katsarilis. Thanks for listening.